changes. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And as we go riding,
you're listening to episode 559 of Unwelcome Guests, Famine, the Fruit of Disconnection. That rather cryptic title, my attempt to draw together the threads of this show. We're looking at possibility of coming global famine. We've heard a lot of different crises over the years, whether it's falling water tables or lack of species diversity, climate change, a whole bunch of individually very serious crises which are interrelated, making solving them that much more complex. And it seems to me the only sensible, sane response is to say we're not going to solve these crises by tinkering with the existing systems. Things are going to have to work completely differently. As an illustration of just how insane things have become in the US, how distanced from reality and how atrophied and terrified of change the powers that be have become, I learnt last week of Julie Bass in Oak Park, Michigan, who is currently battling the city over a vegetable garden in her front yard. The lawn was torn up to lay down a pipe, and rather than replace it with grass, she thought she'd plant vegetables. However, the city decided this was not the thing, so she was charged with a misdemeanor. City code says that all unpaved portions of the site shall be planted with grass or ground cover or shrubbery or other suitable live plant material. Is it suitable to plant vegetables in your front garden? Well, Oak Park's planning and technology director, Kevin Rulkowski, says no. Quote, if you look at the dictionary, suitable means common. You can look throughout the city and you'll never find another garden that consumes the entire front yard, unquote. So, the only allowed thing is what is already done. Any type of change is illegal. If you'd like to keep up with Julie's story, she has a website, oakparkhatesveggies.wordpress.com. Her pre-trial hearing is on July the 26th. She faces 3 months in jail if convicted. Now, I hope that story strikes you as a remarkably blatant example of the insanity of the system in the US. In Bangladesh, where 3/4 of the people are farmers, it's pretty hard for anybody to imagine, firstly, that you could conceive of a law like that. Secondly, that anybody actually would want to put it on the books. Thirdly, that anybody would take it seriously enough to try and enforce it. I think it may be not very many years from now when the ludicrousness of the whole edifice of laws, policies, centralized hierarchies, that is, people acting as subhumans, people who are ready to disregard ideas of virtue in favor of ideas of duty and compulsion, when that just comes crashing down. Our first speaker, courtesy of Radio EcoShock, is Julian Cribb, and he's introduced by Alex Smith. This is from November 2010.
What kind of fringe alarmist warns us about the coming global famine? Actually, he's one of the big voices from Australia. Julian Cribb has published over 7,000 articles and written or edited 8 books. He's won 32 awards as a journalist and held prestigious positions in several institutions. He's an influential Australian, to say the least. Julian Cribb, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you, Alex.
You've had an eye on agriculture for many years. Last spring, you warned of a developing crisis in the food supply. Was that because of the drought in the best farming regions of Australia, or was it a larger picture that pushed you?
It was the larger picture that pushed me. I mean, as you say, I've been watching what's been going on in agriculture worldwide, and I've been aware for many years that we haven't been reinvesting in agricultural science and technology like we used to do in the 1970s. I mean, basically, the world population has doubled since that time, but our emphasis on agricultural science has dwindled. That was worrying me. But then I began to look at the other factors, like, you know, have we got enough water? Have we got enough land? What are we going to do when oil becomes scarce or very expensive? And when you start to put it together, it becomes clear that feeding the human species through this huge peak in numbers and demand of the mid-century is going to be a very challenging thing indeed.
Population growth does seem central to your argument. I heard your speech as a podcast from the University of Melbourne, and you talked about projections of 9 to 12 billion people. And, you know, my inner voice resisted that. I think, well, that'll never happen. Some disease or war will stop it. But I think maybe we all have a denial mechanism for population, just like we do for climate change. We don't want it to happen, so we think it won't. Do you run into that?
Yes. I mean, people are reluctant to understand the realities of population growth. But, you know, it's not just the realities of population growth. It's the fact that every single one of us, when we open our mouths and put food in them, we are eating vastly more energy, more water, more resources than we ever ate before in human history. So it's, the world food demand is going to double. But that is partly due to population growth, but it's also partly due to the absolutely uncontrolled demand for food that we have in our fast-growing economies.
We're all eating more, and of course, many of the people of the world now want to eat more meat, and that requires a lot more resources. Is that the kind of thing you're talking about?
Absolutely, and the fact that we're trashing half our food. I mean, in America, in Australia, in Europe, and so on, half the food goes straight in the garbage. So we're producing a lot of food that we're not eating at all. So yes, we're eating far more, and hence you've got a global pandemic of obesity. And of course, you've got China and India exploring the delights of meat and dairy produce and so on for the first time, and they are of course ramping up their demand for protein-rich foods.
It's important to note that you're predicting regional famines and wars. Maybe other places will continue to feed their populations. Where would the food hotspots be?
Well, I think that the crisis areas are going to be mainly on the Indo-Gangetic Plains and the North China Plain, possibly also in Central Asia and the Middle East, and possibly also in North Africa and Sub-Sahelian Africa. Those are the areas most likely to run out of food and to experience severe local famines. But the point about the book is to say that nobody in the world is going to be untouched by this, because we've already seen just this year how a drought in Russia caused corn prices to soar in the United States and affect prices for food in supermarkets. Everybody is going to be touched, at least in terms of the cost of food, by this. And of course, if there are refugee crises with refugees flooding all over the world and major conflicts arising, then we get affected that way too. So we need to be concerned about it. Famine is not something that happens in a faraway country and can't touch us any longer. It can touch us in very real ways.
Well, I'm really glad you brought that up. I mean, the United States is currently, they have 40 million people receiving food stamp aid, and the doctors are saying we're eating badly and subsisting on fat and sugar. And when you add in the rapidly increasing costs at the grocery store, I wonder, maybe a hidden famine is already developing, even in some allegedly wealthy countries. What would your thoughts on that be?
Well, there's certainly a great deal of inequity about food distribution, even in wealthy countries like the United States and Australia. Difficult problem to fix, of course. The thing we need to worry about, if there was a major famine breakout in Asia, for example, and food prices in the United States doubled, probably half the U.S. population would be unable to afford it. So you would then see a very real impact on ordinary sort of middle-class Americans. So that's the kind of thing we need to worry about. It's the kind of thing we need to think about preventing. And it's caused primarily by the fact that, you know, we're stealing from farmers the things that they need to produce food. We're taking away their water. We're taking away their land. Oil is going to become very scarce over the next 10 years or so. Fertilizer is running out worldwide. It's going to take a while to run out, but it's running out. It's finite. We haven't invested in agricultural science like we should have done. the climate is changing, and that's making agricultural production much more unstable, more prone to drought and so on. And, of course, the oceans are running out of fish. So you add all these things together, you know, you start to see the scale of the problem that we're up against.
Yeah, fish is very important to the food chain for more than just eating the fish, which a lot of people do depend on, but also it's being used as a feed for animal stocks around the world, and we may run out of them, as you say.
Well, currently we eat about 100 million tons of wild-caught fish a year, and that's been stagnant for the last decade. We are not going to be able to double the fish catch from the oceans at the same time as world food demand doubles. So whatever happens, we're going to have to find 100 million tons more protein from land. Now, 100 million tons of protein means you're going to have to grow a billion tons of grain. And to grow a billion tons of grain, you need to discover one more North America. But you add to that the fact that meat consumption is rising worldwide in China and India, as we've discussed. FAO says we're going to increase meat consumption by 185 million tons. Well, that basically means that we would need to find three more North Americas in order to produce all of that protein by the mid part of this century using current techniques. So you can see that's just a way of putting in perspective the size of the challenge that we're up against. We've got to basically triple world protein production.
And a lot of this is in your book. Tell us about the title and what the book is about.
Well, I call it The Coming Famine, the World Food Crisis, and what we can do to avoid it. And my take on it is that it's a world famine because no matter where it breaks out, and it's going to break out many times in the next 50 years, it's going to affect everybody, you know, in terms of food prices, in terms of political instability, trade instability, and so on. I do believe it's avoidable. I believe we can solve this problem if we farm and produce food in a much more sustainable fashion and we recycle our nutrients and we go to sustainable forms of energy for agriculture and so on. But I don't think we're focusing nearly hard enough on the problem at the moment in order to develop those solutions. So I think we're in for some nasty shocks before we actually solve the problem. However, I emphasize, I do believe it's soluble. I'm an optimist about, you know, the ability of human beings to deal with these kinds of issues.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. We are talking about a possible collapse of the global food system in the coming decades. Our guest is the well-known Australian journalist and advisor Julian Cribb. Julian, right now, the United States and Europe, and I assume Australia, are sending millions of tons of food aid to Africa and Asia. Can that continue, and what happens if it stops?
Well, you know, it's just what we call a Band-Aid in Australia, a sticking plaster for the problem. The issue is that Africa and the developing world need to grow their own food. We produce more than enough food for them, but at the end of the day, we're not prepared to pay to have it shipped to all of it, to have it shipped to Africa and to be distributed and, you know, all the freezer trucks and the railways and things you'd have to build to distribute food in Africa. It's much more effective if Africans grow their own food, if Indians grow their own food, if Chinese grow their own food. And that means distributing knowledge, agricultural knowledge. But at the moment, I mean, there's 1.8 billion farmers worldwide. There's an awful lot of farmers. And getting the knowledge to them is a very inefficient sort of chain at the moment. We're not focusing on that either. We're doing lots of research. Well, not quite enough. But we're hardly focusing at all on the challenge of getting new knowledge, sustainable farming knowledge, into the hands of those 1.8 billion farmers. So that's an area that really needs to be tackled rather than thinking of America as a grain basket that's going to feed Africa, because, frankly, that's not going to happen. It hasn't happened in the last 40 years, and it's probably not going to happen in the next 40.
You brought up the case of Russia that suffered a severe heat wave in the summer of 2010, and what they did was they stopped their international grain exports. Can you see that we will have in the future countries that just shut down the international food markets?
Oh, yes. I mean, if you go back to 2008, when world oil prices went to $160 a barrel and there was a crisis in rice worldwide and in other grains, countries like Vietnam and so on stopped exporting rice as well. These kinds of things, the first thing that a government does when it gets into one of those crises is to stop exports. And that, of course, destabilizes the world market and drives up the prices even higher. So it, in fact, makes the problem even worse. And this is the difficulty we're dealing with. We're dealing with governments who have got this very, very short-term view of agriculture. They wait until there is a crisis before they do anything. They don't plan to prevent the crisis. And that's the reason I've written the book, to say there are things we can do. There are lots of things we can do, but we're not thinking about those things. We're not taking the long-term view. We're just waiting for the crisis to happen.
And during the recent drought that happened in Australia, when there was a question of whether farmers should get the water or cities should get the water, it seems like a no-brainer that the residents of the cities are going to demand their water. We can see more of that coming up in the future.
Yeah, that's because we've got very stupid governments, and they think, well, Australia's a rich country, we sell all that iron ore to China, and we can afford to buy food from overseas. But in reality, this is an agriculturally rich country, and we should be supporting our own farmers first, and we should be encouraging them to be even more water-efficient than they are. I mean, they are the world's most water-efficient farmers. They grow more food with less water than anyone else on Earth. But we need to supply them with the science and technology to help them do more of that. And by the way, that's what all farmers worldwide, in America and in everywhere, in Africa, are going to need over the coming 50, 60, 70 years as climate change hammers home. All farmers are going to be dealing with much more unpredictable climates, more droughts, more intense droughts, heavier deluges of rainfall that flood crops and things like that. So farmers are going to have to be much more flexible, and they're going to have a wider variety of crop types that they can grow to stand up to these intensifying climate hits. The area of the world's farmland is shrinking by 1% a year at current rates, and this means that by 2050, 2060, we will have less than half our current area of farmland if we don't stop this. Now, it's shrinking for two reasons. One, because it's being degraded by the economic pressures and others we're putting on our farmers. But two, it's shrinking because the cities are stealing the land from the farmers. And worldwide, by 2050, the footprint of the world's cities will occupy a land area equal to the size of China. And the footprint of those cities' recreational catchment, that's all the area they use for golf courses and recreational farms and things like that, hobby farms, that's going to occupy a land area equal to the size of the United States. And that's all on the world's best farmland, because it's all in river valleys where cities are, or coastal plains. So that's going to be subtracted from agriculture, making the whole of the agricultural system much more at risk, much more risky and unpredictable at a time when food supply is becoming more jeopardized. So we've got to think very hard before we just take up more land at the fringe of the city and turn it into urban blocks.
Oh, we see it all the time. People, farmers think, well, there's my multi-million dollar cash, I'll sell out, and we always rule with our bylaws in favor of putting more buildings, and yes, we must have parks and walkways and all the things that we demand in the city. So I don't know how we're going to stop that. Most of the world's population is moving into these megacities.
Well, the megacities will have populations of between 7 and 8 billion by the mid-century total. And some of those cities will be 20, 30, and 40 million people in size, and they will have almost no internal food capacity. So if the trucks don't come every single night bringing more food, what will happen in one of those giant cities? If the trucks are prevented by a fuel crisis or a local war or something, you will have starvation within a week in those giant cities. And it will be a horrendous scene. It'll be like, World War II, the end of World War II, the starvation that went on in Eastern Europe. And people are not aware of that the cities no longer support themselves food-wise. So we really need to redesign our cities so that they start recycling nutrients and water and producing more of their own food.
There is a small movement here in North America, transition towns and people who are trying to get communal gardens going in the cities and looking at rooftop gardening and all of that. But it's such a tiny little fleck. As you say, if the trucks stop running, I think people would just have to walk away from the cities, possibly.
Well, where would they go, of course? The farmers will be waiting there trying to stop them getting into their crops. You will have mass starvation in these great megacities, and there will be almost nothing we can do. So that's the kind of food shock that I think that we will see before the world really wakes up to the extent of its peril. But as I say, it's totally preventable. Growing your own veggies is a great thing to do, but it's not going to solve the problem of feeding a city. We need to have an industrialized hydroponic systems and things like that will produce enough fruit and vegetables to help the city get by.
Here in Canada, the Canadian military historian Gwyn Dyer, he's predicted serious wars, possibly even nuclear wars, if the global food trade fails. Have you put that into your book, the possibility of struggles and wars?
Yes, indeed, I have. People have actually forgotten that food, land, and water are at the root of most serious human disputes. If you peel away the superficial layers of conflict between different political groups or religious groups or ethnic groups, underneath you find people are arguing about food, land, and water. I mean, Darfur basically is a war between farmers and cowboys. Rwanda started off as an argument between cattle graziers and farmers. Eritrea and the Horn of Africa is all about agricultural failure being enmeshed with war. Even the Balkans was a fight over that. We know the Russian Revolution and the French Revolution going further back in history. You know, both cases, governments were torn down by people who were starving and angry as a result of their starvation. So we know that famine leads to war, leads to governments being torn down. And that's Guendouya's hypothesis. It's based on sound thinking by the big military think tanks in Washington and in the UK and elsewhere and in Scandinavia. They're all saying the same thing. Food, land, and water are primary drivers of conflict in this age. And if we want to avoid war, one way we can de-escalate the tensions is by ensuring that everyone is fed.
Peace through better farming. Julian Cribb, when do food shortages and famine get really serious in your view?
Well, in my view, what we're going to see is a number of shocks as we approach 2050, and each shock will be bigger than the last one if we don't take the kind of preventive actions that I'm outlining. As we say, we had the grain price shock in 2008. 2 years later, we've got a Russian drought shock. What are we going to have in 2012? I don't know, but it will be something. What is going to happen to food prices when oil prices go back to $160 or even $200 or $300 a barrel? I mean, when that happens, a lot of farmers are going to have to give up using tractors. Worldwide. So that's going to affect food prices directly. So it's not just climatic things that affect food prices, it's also these other scarcities. If there are scarcities in fertilizer supplies, and we've seen, you know, the Australian company BHP bidding for Canadian potash recently, well, they're not doing that because it's Be Kind to Farmers Week. They're doing that because they expect to get very rich. And they think that potash is going to be in scarce supply over the next 50 years, and they're making a bid to invest in the biggest producer in the world. So, you know, you can see that people are already speculating about these kinds of scarcities that are coming down. We need to do something about that. There are lots of things that we can do about it. I mean, in the case of potash and phosphorus, you can recycle the stuff that comes out the bottom end of cities. Instead of throwing our food in the garbage, we can recycle the nutrients. Instead of wasting our sewage effluent, we can recycle the nutrients. But we're not doing any of that at the moment, or very little of it.
And I know that in our school system, there isn't even a hint that anyone would want to become a farmer. So it seems like we need a social reorganization to appreciate where our food comes from again.
Well, two things. I think that to feed the human race in 2050, 2060, we're probably going to have to do two things. One, we're going to have to revolutionize the way we produce food in the ways that I'm outlining in the book. Secondly, we're also going to have to ask human beings to eat at a slightly lower level. That means perhaps doubling the amount of vegetables in the diet and halving the amount of meat and high protein. That would be good for us, by the way, because, I mean, our current Western diet kills a half of all consumers. You know, they're dying of heart disease, cancer, diabetes, obesity, and all of that sort of, all those different degenerative diseases. So to eat a bit lighter and to eat more vegetables would actually help them live longer and would also reduce the massive blowout in healthcare costs in every single Western country in the world. The healthcare cost is the leading budget item these days. So eating more healthily will help conserve the resource base, which grows our food worldwide. It will also make us healthier people, and it will reduce the cost burdens on our economies. So it makes sense from a number of perspectives. But how do you do that? Well, my suggestion is that we put a year of food into every junior school on the planet, in which every subject that you teach at school is taught through the lens of food. So when you study maths, you study food. When you study science, you study how plants grow and animals reproduce and things like that. When you study sport, you learn about diet and fitness and things like that. So that you're imbued with much more respect and understanding for food when you come out of your junior school year than you had when you went into it. And I think that's the only way we're going to wake people up. We're going to have something that's fairly universal. But it's easy to do. I mean, food is acceptable in all cultures and creeds.
You've brought up so many important threads there. Is there a website for your book?
Well, there's only the website at the University of California Press where the book is being marketed. I have a website called World Food Crisis, which I run mainly science stories of people who are trying to address this problem, and that's at www.sciencealert.com.au/World Food Crisis.
And give us the name of your book one more time.
It's The Coming Famine, The World Food Crisis, and What We Can Do to Avoid It.
Now, I think he's missed the point that schools are not there to prepare children for lives of independence, but to prepare them for lives of subservience to a larger system. And as long as governments are trying to nail people for growing food on their own land, then I think it's unlikely they're going to be doing things like teaching people how to farm or stay healthy. But I think absolutely he's right that large-scale famines are a possibility because of the ongoing ecocide, not because of the numbers. I think it might have to come to that to wake people up. If I ask, how do you plan on feeding yourself and your family? If the first thing that springs to mind is numbers, then I think you've got to reassess your priorities. Unless you believe that the current system of food, markets, deliveries, fossil fuel-based agriculture, unless that's going to continue for the rest of your lifetime, which, unless you're quite old, I think might not be the case, then focusing instead on what you can grow in the nearby area might be a good one. Now, maybe you think, well, I live in a city, there's not a lot I can do. Certainly the system would like you to think that, and there might be some crazy laws on the books to try and tell you you can't, but I live in a city of about 15 million, many of them hungry, and it never fails to amaze me just how many scraps of spare land there are for guerrilla gardening, seed bombing. And I'm growing stuff on the roof now, and most of the roofs that I can see are plain concrete, so there's no actual green, not even a flower pot, which shows the unused capacity, shows where people have been putting their efforts. The system doesn't encourage you to be self-sustaining and independent. It encourages you to be subservient and dependent. Not to get too philosophical, but here is Ivan Illich's take on that. He's talking, in one sense, I guess, about literal soil, but also figuratively about the need for people to connect with the place around them. And he talks about virtue, and he's not talking about laws. He's talking about individual ideas of right and wrong. So this is only a short piece by Ivan Illich and his philosopher friends, published in 1990, called A Declaration on Soil. The ecological discourse about planet Earth, global hunger, threats to life, urges us to look down at the soil humbly as philosophers. We stand on soil, not on earth. From soil we come, and to soil we bequeath our excrements and remains. And soil, its cultivation and our bondage to it, is remarkably absent from those things clarified by philosophy in our Western tradition. As philosophers, we search below our feet because our generation has lost its grounding in both soil and virtue. By virtue, we mean that shape, order, and direction of action informed by tradition, bounded by place, and qualified by choices made within the habitual reach of the actor. We mean practice mutually recognized as being good, within a shared local culture that enhances the memories of a place. We note that such virtue is traditionally found in labor, craft, dwelling, and suffering, supported not by an abstract earth, energy, or environment system, but by the particular soil these very actions have enriched with their traces. Yet, in spite of this ultimate bond between soil and being, soil and the good, philosophy has not brought forth the concepts that would allow us to relate virtue to common soil, something vastly different from managing behavior on a shared planet. We were torn from bonds to soil, the connections that limited action, making practical virtue possible, when modernization insulated us from plain dirt, from toil, flesh, soil, and grave. The economy into which we have been absorbed, some willy-nilly, some at great cost, transforms people into interchangeable morsels of population, ruled by the laws of scarcity. Commons and homes are barely imaginable to persons hooked on public utilities and garaged in furnished cubicles. Bread is a mere foodstuff, if not calories or roughage. To speak of friendship, religion, and joint suffering as a style of conviviality, after the soil has been poisoned and cemented over, appears like academic dreaming to people randomly scattered in vehicles, offices, prisons, and hotels. As philosophers, we emphasize the duty to speak about soil. For Plato, Aristotle, and Galen, it could be taken for granted. Not so today. Soil on which culture can grow and corn be cultivated is lost from view when it is defined as a complex subsystem, sector, resource, problem, or farm, as agricultural science tends to do. As philosophers, we offer resistance to those ecological experts who preach respect for science but foster neglect for historical tradition, local flair, and the earthy virtue, self-limitation. Sadly, but without nostalgia, we acknowledge the pastness of the past. With diffidence, then, we attempt to share what we see, some results of the earth's having lost its soil, and we are irked by the neglect for soil in the discourse carried on among boardroom ecologists. But we are also critical of many among well-meaning romantics, Luddites, and mystics who exalt soil, making it the matrix not of virtue, but of life. Therefore, we issue a call for the philosophy of soil, a clear, disciplined analysis of that experience and memory of soil which neither virtue nor some new kind of subsistence can be. I find Illich always enigmatic, always worth thinking about. So I haven't had much feedback from you on Illich. If you've got strong feelings either way, you can drop me a note, unwelcome@unwelcomeguest.net, to let me know how you think. Now, as another example of insane overreach, what Illich once referred to as the war on subsistence, we're going to hear an interview with David Gumpert, author of Raw Milk Revolution, about the case of Dan Alger, an Amish farmer accused of illicit trade in raw milk. And this interview is by Michael Olson of Food Chain Radio. Now, he writes the three laws of the food chain. First law, agriculture is the foundation upon which we build all our sand castles. Without a surplus of food, there can be no time for anything but finding enough food. Agriculture is the industry that provides us with a surplus of food, and thus is the most important of all our endeavours. This elemental fact is often lost to the many who no longer have any connection to the food chain, other than their occasional forays to grocery stores and restaurants, where they expect to always find food. Second law. The farther we go from the source of our food, the less control we have over what's in our food. When we are close to the source of our food, we know what's in our food. But when our food comes from far away, we must rely on others to ensure that what is promised to be or not to be in our food is indeed in or not in our food. Most of us now eat food that comes from over 1,000 miles away, so we have little, if any, control over what is or what is not in the food we eat. Third law, cheap food isn't. Cheap food is the big lie. They make food cheap by diminishing its substance and by subsidizing its cost. Thus, the cheap food they promise is really the expensive food they deliver. Now, as a side note to that last point, last week I read about the addition of cellulose, that's wood pulp, in processed food. Apparently it's all over the place in processed food. Now, you might be wondering, why would people put wood pulp in food? Well, of course, the answer is because it's cheap and they're in the business of making money, not the business of making good food. Certainly doesn't make a great deal of sense according to the virtue that Illich was talking about. If it strikes you as sheer common sense, yes, of course they'll put whatever they feel like in food. That's a sign, perhaps, you're overexposed to commercial pressures. Now let's hear the interview about raw milk, unprocessed, fresh from the cow, something I've greatly enjoyed here in Bangladesh, but something which is approaching the status of a controlled substance in the US.
Folks, the forces of prohibition are once more on the march, this time in rural Pennsylvania, where the Food and Drug Administration of the United States of America is prosecuting Amish farmer Dan Alger for selling fresh, whole, unpasteurized milk to his neighbors across the line in Washington, D.C. This prohibition began in earnest back in 1987 when the FDA determined, as stated on its website, that raw milk can carry harmful bacteria and other germs that can make you very sick or kill you. While it is true that unpasteurized milk may contain harmful pathogens, as may all uncooked food, we wonder at the numbers. How many people get sick and die from drinking fresh, whole, unpasteurized milk? In scanning the net, we could find no deaths documented in the published scientific literature that were attributed to drinking fresh, unprocessed whole milk that was produced on a dairy in the United States. The government's prosecution of Farmer Dan and all the other small farmers that is going on across this great land of ours leads us to ask today, how did fresh, whole, unpasteurized milk from cows become an illicit substance? Why do some consumers prefer fresh, whole, unpasteurized milk over that milk produced in giant commercial dairies? And who or what is threatened when farmers sell milk from cows to consumers? Here to help us find an answer, we have David Gumpert, the author of The Raw Milk Revolution. David, welcome to The Food Chain.
Great to be here, Michael.
Good to have you aboard. Now, listen, I have a question to ask. As a young boy being raised in Chicago, did you ever imagine that you would be helping lead a revolt in Washington, D.C. with a cow?
No, I didn't. It for any number of reasons, it was a long ways from my mind. I was as you suggest, I'm a city boy. I've always lived in big cities. I was born and raised in Chicago. I lived in New York City for a while, and then around the 1970s, I've been in the Boston area, and so always been in cities. Don't know much about agriculture, although I've learned a little bit in the last few years. Always admired people who could grow food because that was just so far from my own experience and my own abilities. What we are experiencing in this country is just a lot more awareness of the importance of food.
What about the terms here? I prefer, I don't know about the word raw milk. I think I prefer fresh, whole, unpasteurized. But then if I say fresh and whole, I'll bet those words are already owned by the conventional dairy industry.
Yeah, you're right. And I agree, raw is an unfortunate term because it connotes something, I don't know, that hasn't been treated or in a negative kind of a way. But you're right, those like fresh and whole. I'm not absolutely certain, but I think probably the whole milk is technically a term applied to milk that has, 3% or 4%.
Sure, so I'm sure those terms are already owned, and they're going to throw us in jail for using them.
Yeah,
right after Dan, they're going to come for us.
Trademark violation.
I think about back to my youth and being raised on the grandparents' farm and everything, and I remember milking cows and carrying buckets of milk to the house and pouring them in the separator and taking the cream and the milk and putting them in the refrigerator and taking some to the neighbors and trading them for this and that. And how did that goodness become illegal? I guess that's what confuses me most about the subject. How did it happen that something so intrinsically honest and good, though maybe a little poopy, has become illegal? What on earth? How did this start?
Raw milk, or fresh whole milk, as you say, has an unfortunate history in the U.S. Everyone before 1900 was drinking unpasteurized milk. Unfortunately, when the Industrial Revolution occurred in the mid-1800s, millions of people moved from the countryside into the cities. Cows went with them. But people didn't understand. I mean, no one understood, really, the importance of things like good sanitation and a healthy diet for the cows and so forth. And so the cows brought to the city were often raised under really terrible conditions. So they were placed in what are really the first feedlots in this country.
Right. Weren't they often, David, used as kind of like urban garbage disposal units for distilleries?
Yes. And the leftover from the distilleries was often fed to the cows so that the distilleries kind of had an additional source of income. But the cows were unhealthy, and the milk they produced was unhealthy. Not to mention, it was the people doing the milking often had contagious diseases like tuberculosis, and so what you had was a recipe for disaster, and that's what you got. You got massive outbreaks of disease, not just from milk, but from bad water and
just about
other foods that were bad. But milk, because it was being fed to children. You had a lot of the outbreaks were affecting children, and you had many thousands of children dying in outbreaks from typhoid and tuberculosis, brucellosis.
And I spoke with a person who actually contracted brucellosis from raw milk back in the 1940s, and it was a harrowing experience for her.
Yeah.
Now, have we not taken care of that problem?
Well, it was thought that pasteurization took care of that problem. And in a sense, it did. I mean, I really don't take the attitude that this is an either-or thing. I mean, I'm not trying to discredit pasteurization, and I'm not trying to suggest that we should go back to drinking all milk unpasteurized. Far from it. All I'm asking or all I'm advocating is that we have a choice, and if those of us who don't want pasteurized milk want to drink it unpasteurized, we should be able to do that. But no, I don't. Pasteurization served an important purpose, I think, in terms of reducing disease at a time when we really didn't either understand or have the means to provide, like refrigeration and sanitation and those kinds of things that that were required.
And we
have those now. And the other thing that's changed is, as you just suggested, the diseases that people got, like brucellosis, are not around anymore. I mean, they've been pretty much eradicated. So when people get sick from raw milk or from any foodborne illness, and it's important to keep that in mind, if people can get sick from any food, they almost always get sick today from one of four pathogens that are the same, no matter what the food is. But it's E. coli 0157H7, it's Salmonella, it's Campylobacter, and I'll think of the fourth one. But it's they're the same, and they're not, for the most part, anywhere near as dangerous as the brucellosis and the tuberculosis and the typhoid of that earlier time.
So essentially, we've kind of gotten rid of most of the big problems. Now, looking at the numbers, do we see great swaths of people getting sick from raw milk as we did with the eggs, the spinach, the peanut butter, things like that?
I don't think we do. I mean, and I say, I have to say that because there are people who in the Food and Drug Administration and in the Centers for Disease Control who will dispute me, but I have yet to see them do it with anything more than kind of fear-mongering type stories where they talk about children who become very sick or and so on and so forth. But if you look at the data, tells a story pretty clearly that we don't have a very serious problem, and anything we don't have anything that can begin to be called a serious public health problem from raw milk. And just to give you a quick synopsis of the data from because I've looked at it from this is CDC data I'm talking about from 1973 through 2005. The average number of illnesses from raw milk reported to the CDC were 54 each year.
54 a year?
Yeah, 54 a year. Now, for each, that's obviously a low number, but for each illness, now this isn't just for raw milk, once again, we're talking about any food. For every illness, there's some number that usually on the order of 15 to 30 unreported illnesses.
Right.
So if you take that number and just say 54 and multiply it times 20, say there are 20 unreported illnesses for each one that's reported, you may be looking at 1,000 illnesses per year. Now, that's still a very low number in the foodborne illness scheme of things because, I mean, we're talking about a situation in which the CDC says, I think it's the latest estimate is something like 46 million illnesses every year.
So out of 46 million foodborne illnesses every year, we get 54 from raw milk?
Well, I don't want to make that exact comparison, but let's say it's 1,000 or even 2,000. It's it's a tiny percentage of the overall number of foodborne illnesses.
So, yeah, not enough to really rage war over or establish a whole new prohibition over, but and yet that's what's happening, or at least it seems to me, by following this story for a number of years, it seems to be that is the case. Why did the government make it illegal to sell fresh, whole, unpasteurized milk across state lines in 1987? I mean, that's fairly fairly recent.
That's another sad story in the whole history of raw milk. It's ironic because leading up to 1987, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, under President Reagan, was opposed to a prohibition on interstate sale of raw milk. The FDA was actually dragged kicking and screaming into enforcing such a prohibition by a court suit brought by a consumers group of citizens who contended that raw milk had become dangerous. Now, from all that I can tell in kind of reconstructing what was going on then, a lot of the concern over raw milk that these the citizens group had came from California, where there was a dairy known as Altadena.
Yep.
And Altadena was really a huge dairy. I think thousands of cows, I'm going to say 8,000 cows. And they supplied most of the raw milk, not only for California, but for much of the western part of the country for many years. But there were illnesses coming out of there, and there was a huge debate over how serious the illnesses were, how many were from Altadena, how many could be blamed on raw milk. Altadena believed very strongly in the benefits of raw milk and safety of raw milk, and supplied much of the western part of the U.S. with raw milk. Remember, there was no prohibition on interstate sales at that time. And a consumer group brought suit against the FDA. When the FDA wouldn't take action in instituting a ban on interstate sales, the citizen group brought suit in federal court, and a federal judge ordered the FDA to develop regulations to prohibit the interstate sale of raw milk. So the FDA did that. And so from their point of view, they did what they were told. And now what's happened since the FDA did that is that the scientists and the regulators within the FDA have become, I guess, what you might call believers. They now think that this is an important mission that they have, mm-hmm. to regulate the distribution or the sale of raw milk, and they take it very seriously.
And it gives them a significant way of controlling local food.
Yes, it does. It does.
So the sad story of Altadena, I guess Altadena's still around, though, right?
Selling. I believe they're still around, but they don't sell raw milk. They haven't been selling unpasteurized milk since the late 1990s, I believe.
So
1999 or
most of the raw dairies I know are very small and kind of family centered, but they they don't seem to be able to adopt this industrial scale. Although Farmer Dan there in Pennsylvania seems to be doing pretty good. He's got, 1,000 people in his buying club?
Yeah, that's the buying club he was serving had I think, about 900 people. So I don't know how many cows he has exactly, but I don't think, I would venture it's fewer than 100 cows.
So let me ask the next question, of course, is why do some consumers prefer fresh, whole, unpasteurized milk over that milk produced in giant industrialized dairies? What happened to you to convince you to drink raw milk, David Gumpert, your city boy?
Right. Well, I've always enjoyed milk growing up as a kid and a teenager, and kind of got away from it in my 30s and 40s just because I kind of took to heart the advice to reduce fat consumption. And so I had gotten away from it. But when I started reading about raw milk in 2005 or thereabouts, I was curious. I actually was reading about it, and then I saw at a farmer's market in Vermont that there was some for sale. And I talked to the farmer, and I liked what she had to say, and I bought some of her milk, and I tried it, and it just tasted so wonderful. I stayed with it. But I think some people do that. They just really appreciate the taste. I've heard some people say it's like ice cream in a bottle. And it's just a very rich, creamy taste that's kind of like if you enjoyed milk as a kid, it's just like that except better. But there are other people who say that it helps them with various chronic issues.
Such as
lactose intolerance.
Mm-hmm. And there's a reason for that, right?
Well, there's all kinds of debate about whether raw milk makes a difference in lactose intolerance. And there was a study done on that at Stanford about a year ago, which suggested that raw milk doesn't have any influence on lactose intolerance. But it then becomes very important how you define lactose intolerance. And they defined it very narrowly. And, in fact, were only able to find, I think, about a dozen people for the study who had lactose intolerance under their criteria. But there is a larger number of people who have trouble with pasteurized milk, and I don't know, you know, whether it's lactose intolerance or whether it's simply an allergy, they can't tolerate pasteurized dairy products, but they can tolerate raw milk or raw dairy products. So for these people, and the FDA estimates there are something on the order of 30 million to 50 million such people out there, for these people, or at least some of them, can now, with raw milk, enjoy dairy products. That's a big deal. I mean, because if you're limited to not being able to have any dairy products, why, you know, you can't have yogurt, you can't have ice cream, you can't have various cheeses. So it's an imposition. The other thing is there are other conditions like, say, Crohn's. People who have Crohn's sometimes say they find a tremendous amount of relief. Chronic fatigue syndrome, things like that. There was a study out of Europe of about 5,000 children, which showed that, this was just done in the last 4 or 5 years, that children who consumed raw milk had something like a 25% lower incidence of asthma and allergies than children who were drinking pasteurized milk. So you have a number of indications that at least for some people, raw milk has some health benefits. And that's something, you know, I think that's important. I mean, I respect that. I mean, the FDA and the CDC will say, well, that hasn't been scientifically proven.
Mm-hmm. Wouldn't it be difficult to scientifically prove in something that has such a high degree of variability as raw milk? I mean, raw milk can only have in it what the cow ate in the field.
Exactly.
It can't have anything more or anything less.
Right.
And so when you don't really know what the cow was eating, then you can't really say, you know, how do you make a judgment there?
Well, in this European study, and they were feeding what they called, I think, farm fresh milk to children, and obviously it was coming from different sources, but they found this statistical fact associated with it, and so. I mean, they concluded that it was the milk that was the factor in reducing asthma and allergies. So, but it is hard to study, certainly. I think the important point here, though, is that the government scientists, regulators, deny all this. And in fact, they say that when they will even talk about it, most of the time they won't discuss it. But those who have discussed it find fault with the European study, for instance, and they find technical things. Well, it wasn't clear that it was always raw milk that the children were drinking. The families might have boiled some of the milk, and you get into all these technicalities. But it's an unfortunate situation. I mean, I think that the people are getting health benefits from something as just a basic food like that. Well, why try to deny it to them?
Washington, D.C. this week, when a bunch of people gathered on the grassy knoll there in front of the Capitol and brought a cow to Washington, D.C., and they milked it right there in front of the government, and they drank the raw milk. And David Gumpert, you were part of that. What on earth are those people thinking? Why are they so intent on getting their raw milk?
Well, there are a few things going on. I mean, one is many of them are getting health benefits from the milk. Why they don't understand why the government would want to deny them access to food that's improving their health. Another issue is they are getting access to other foods from Dan Algier. They're not only buying milk; they're getting the eggs and the meat and the butter and the chicken and so forth that we talked about earlier. So, if the government is successful, the government will keep Dan from being able to supply them with any of that. Because I talked about this in my speech in front of the cow and in front of the Capitol, that people don't want to go back to having to buy Purdue chicken. They don't want to have to go back to buying eggs from Iowa suppliers that sickened 3,000 people last summer. They don't want to go back to food that poisons them, in their judgment. And they're not saying that no one should buy these foods, but they don't want to have these foods. So it becomes what I call a food rights issue. It's not just about milk.